You guys know I'm crazy about Audible because it offers an incredible selection of audiobooks across every genre. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, including the latest bestsellers and new releases. Audible really is the destination for thrilling audio entertainment, with female writers and heroines, celebrity narration, multicast productions with immersive sound design, and traditional audiobooks. Audible has you covered for any type of excitement that you're looking for. In fact, right now I'm listening to The Second Husband by Kate White. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/realitylife or text realitylife to 500-500. That's audible.com/realitylife or text realitylife to 500-500. With four daughters and two on a dance team, I can tell you we go through a lot of mascara in my house. But I'm crazy about L'Oreal Paris new Panorama Mascara, which catches every lash from corner to corner for maximum volume. If you're looking for a new high-end mascara without breaking the bank, this is yours. The new L'Oreal Paris Panorama Mascara gives you a high-end lash look in a premium gold luxe packaging. I've been using it for about 2 weeks now, and I feel like my eye has completely opened up, and the girls are crazy about it too. They've got a tapered brush to catch every lash, one of the best mascara wands that I've ever used. And like I said, this luxe appearance of this gold package, you got to get it. You can buy Panorama Mascara on Amazon today. L'Oreal Paris new Panorama Mascara. You're going to love it.
The amazing Kate Casey.
Welcome back to another episode of Reality Life with Kate Casey. Hope that you've had a great week. I have a great episode for you. First, I have to tell you, I want you to check out The Price of Glee, a docuseries on Hulu. It's about Ryan Murphy's musical TV series, Glee, which aired on Fox beginning in 2009. The show quickly exploded. Its success culminated with 32 Emmy nominations, two national tours, a 3D concert movie, and a series of best-selling compilation albums. Add to that, the two leads of the show were in a relationship, so it got plenty of tabloid and media press. But the show has been tainted by a so-called Glee curse due to the tragedies and negative reports that have impacted the show. It's a three-part series. There are interviews with crew members, background actors, close friends, and family members of the Glee cast. First, Corey Monteith was 27 years old when the show premiered. He played high school quarterback Finn Hudson on the show. In 2013, just weeks before filming Glee's fifth season, he died of mixed drug toxicity involving heroin and alcohol. And I remember it very clearly because he died on July 14th and I was in labor with my third. And I just remember sitting in the delivery room thinking what a tragedy it was for someone so young and talented to have passed. In this series, a friend of Corey's from Canada says that he started using alcohol and drugs at the age of 13 following his parents' divorce. Throughout his teen years, he would steal money from his family. And when he was 19, his mom and friends staged an intervention that ended with him entering a drug rehab program in 2001. His friend admits that Corey was worried about his past getting out when he landed this role. He wanted to be known as a good kid. So by the second season, at the end of it, he became more open about his addiction, in part because he had hoped that he would help someone else. But he began to struggle as his fame grew. He even told his former roommate, Justin, that he wouldn't wish fame on his worst enemy. He got to the point where he hated fame. He said, "I'm just so tired. I want to rest for a bit. I'm sick of singing these songs." And it is believed that Corey remained sober until shortly before his death. Doug Kirkpatrick, head of the Glee hair department, claims in the series that it was one of Corey's co-stars who encouraged him to start drinking again. Also, under the microscope, Corey's relationship with his co-star, Lea Michele. So the two leads were in a relationship. Their relationship comes under scrutiny, and most certainly Lea Michele as well. The two struck up a romance in 2012. They remained together until his death. Several crew members said that they were surprised that they were a couple. They remained unsure whether they were good for each other. And I have to say, I do remember reading so many blind items about them as a couple and whether people even believed it. It seemed like it was like a showmance. Well, she was given various options, including taking a hiatus and canceling the show altogether. But she chose for everybody to return to work just 2 weeks after he had died, which people found perplexing, given So many people were impacted by his death, and also that was her boyfriend. As mentioned, she comes under great scrutiny. She's been at the center of multiple scandals since Glee came to an end in 2015. Former castmates have spoke out against her and accused her of bullying and racism. In 2020, Samantha Ware said that Leah made her life on set a living hell, in addition to a series of other racial microaggressions. Amber Riley supported Samantha through the expose and said that it had made her feel liberated by hearing others come forward. Heather Morris added that Leah was very unpleasant to work with. Naya Rivera said that Leah didn't like sharing the spotlight and would purposely ignore her. Garrett Greer, an assistant to the executive director of Glee, fuels these claims in the docuseries. He brands Leah a narcissist and alleges that there was conflict whenever she felt the amount of attention she was receiving was being threatened. Naya Rivera was 22 years old when she was cast as Santana. She tragically died from drowning in 2020. She had her body discovered after her four-year-old son was found alone on a boat. He told investigators that he and his mom had been swimming, but she'd helped him back on the boat but wasn't able to pull herself up to safety. Mark Salling, who starred as Noah, was arrested on the suspicion of possessing child sexual abuse materials after one of his ex-girlfriends came forward to the police. He eventually pled guilty to the charge of receiving and possessing child sexual abuse materials. And in 2018, he was found dead by suicide. In addition, there have been several other crew members that have died during the production of the show, some by suicide, others by heart problems. All of it together just makes for a very perplexing story. There are questions of whether or not the show is too demanding, but certainly so many strange things that have come out of this show. So it's called The Price of Glee, and it's on Hulu. In this episode, I interview Brielle Decker, the 65th wife of self-appointed prophet Warren Jeffs, who is still leading the Fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the FLDS, despite being behind prison walls. For background, the Fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the FLDS, emerged in the early 20th century when its founding members were excommunicated from the Church of Latter-day Saints, the LDS, after they refused to abandon the practice of plural marriage. Colorado City, formerly known as Short Creek, was established by a few families and in the 1930s became the home of the Fundamentalist Mormon FLDS. They chose this remote location so that they could freely practice polygamy, which is the act of having more than one spouse, after breaking ties with the mainline Mormon religion. The FLDS and Short Creek were hit with government raids and has historically caused them to view the outside world and the government as dangerous. So the members of this congregation are not allowed to read books, listen to music, listen to any news reports. They are purposely isolated from the world outside of them, who would obviously have an opposing view to all the teachings and viewpoints of its leader, Warren Jeffs. So, of course, this sets the stage for Jeffs to rise to power, whose teachings and methods of leading the FLDS has caused enormous pain for everyone in the community. Husbands being ripped from families, sexual assault of women and children. Warren Jeffs changed the fabric of this community when he rose to power. He is, as mentioned, a self-proclaimed prophet. In 2002, gained control of the FLDS, transforming the town and taking 80 wives for himself over time. In 2007, he was sentenced to life plus 20 years in prison for taking child brides and sexual abuse with girls as young as 12 years old. So Prisoner of the Prophet on Discovery Plus tells the story of Brielle Decker, the 65th wife of prophet, self-appointed prophet, Warren Jeffs. In this, she tells of her time living and surviving in the Fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Her story exposes the darkest secrets of the polygamous cult. And this airs on January 30th, again on Discovery Plus. It's called Prisoner of the Prophet. You can also go and listen to my previous episode with Alyssa Wall from Keep Sweet, Pray, and Obey, which was a docuseries that aired last year in Netflix. I believe she is the person who brought down the FLDS and Warren Jeffs. Go back and listen to this. Brielle's story is equally harrowing, and I was so grateful to have some time this week to talk to her before the prisoner of profit erred. This story continues to just fascinate me. And as always, I'm so impressed with those that have come forward and told their stories. So here we go with Brielle Decker. Imagine upgrading your wardrobe with luxury essentials at unbeatable prices. Quince is here to transform the way that you shop with a range of high-quality items priced within reach, like 100% Mongolian cashmere sweaters for $50, organic cotton sweaters, washable silk tops, and timeless 14-karat gold jewelry. And the best part? All Quince items are priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman, and they pass the savings on to us. So I just got a 100% organic cotton tiered maxi skirt in red and a chiffon pleated midi skirt in soft pink. Now I'm going to wear both of them with either a white scoop t-shirt or a black tank top. In fact, wait, should we all get the same outfit and meet for drinks? Indulge in affordable luxury. Go to quince.com/KKC for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/KKC to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/KKC. This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. If you're looking for new style inspiration, Saks.com is the place to go. Saks.com is making it easy for me to shop for the spring with their selection of chic clothes and accessories. Right now, I'm looking at Saks.com so I can find my new going out vibe. I'm looking for a breezy Zimmerman dress for an evening cocktail party. And for my upcoming conference in Los Angeles, I'm looking at bright Chloe blazers because I'm pushing myself to wear more orange and pink. Saks.com will inspire you to shop for everything on your agenda. So find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Your family had 14 kids and you are number 11. Tell me what it was like to be indoctrinated from a very young age into this church.
It was like I didn't know anything different. So like as a child, I just thought that I actually believed everything that my parents told me. And there was no reason why not to. It's like a fish growing up in like a fishbowl, you know, like you just don't really realize that you should jump out, you know, until you get older maybe. So for me, it was pretty natural to just believe everything my parents told me. Children usually want to please their parents. They want to live up to the expectations that are, you know, placed on them. They don't always have analytical thinking. The brain doesn't develop until you're older, sometimes 26. So yeah, for me, I had a lot of good experiences, but I also had some really hard ones that changed the course of my life. And a lot of those came because of the church rules, really. Like at 8 years old, then they have a doctrine that says that you get baptized at 8 years old. That if you don't understand the scriptures, the sin goes on the head of the parent. And if you do understand them and you get baptized, then Christ stops atoning for you and you have to atone for yourself at that point. So in my story, after I turned 8 years old and was baptized, I became a target in my family, which I had no idea at that age that I was going to become a target. Because of the church rules, it made so that you were judged as an adult at 8 years old. There was hardly any room for, because of the extreme version of FLDS's extreme version of Mormonism, there was hardly any room for mistakes and things like that.
I'm just trying to imagine the pressure that a parent feels in addition to being overwhelmed with all the kids. You're also being told how to live your life. And so from what you're saying is that you're essentially told that if your children by age 8 don't understand, then it's your fault and it will have implications for the rest of your life.
Right. It's pretty much like, the parent has so much weight. If the child doesn't get baptized at 8 years old, the parent has to carry the weight of the child's sins instead of, because Jesus will atone for you until you're 8 years old. It's all about work. So after 8 years old, then it's either the child that gets baptized and atones for their own weaknesses, or it is the parent that carries that burden for the child.
So as child number 11, growing up, did you feel like
your own sense of purpose is directly in correlation to who you marry and the children that you have.
Yes, very much. The women are taught, basically, like, if you ever hear, like, what the barefoot bride means, you know, like, that statement in general terms is usually you're raised to have kids, like, and that's pretty much what we're raised like. We're raised to be taught about our roles as a mother. Our mission in life was to be a mother in Zion. We were never taught, like, what do you want to be when you grow up? It was always, you will be a mother in Zion. Like, it wasn't anything about what we wanted. It was about what we were going, what our purpose was. God brought us to earth to have kids.
And is everything, as I understand it, everything is centered around this idea of Zion. You were all working towards that.
Yes, yes. They have some doctrines in the faith about, like, when Joseph Smith, the founder of the Mormon faith, tried to establish, like, this holy city in Missouri back, like, it was a long time ago, it was like 9 generations ago or something. And they were driven out of Missouri. And according to the stories the church tells, which is different than the stories people usually hear on the outside, the only stories I was allowed to hear as a child were the ones that the church tells. So their version of it. As I grew up, I would hear about, like, how Joseph Smith was a martyr. He was killed for the church. He died in Illinois, which was next to Missouri. And then the people were pioneers that came back to Utah. And in these stories, it says the reason that they were driven out of Missouri, where their holy city was because one of the members of the, like, some of the members of the church didn't obey every law that God had given them. So all about works. Mm-hmm. And so God put them under condemnation through Joseph Smith. Well, when Warren Jeffs became the leader 9 generations later through a lot of series of things, he said in church that he was called of God to decide who was obeying all the laws and was going to bring them to the holy city. And that's when he started the Yearning for Zion Ranch in Texas. And he had the right to call the people individually, and that's how families started to be broke up. He'd call children sometimes. He'd call different individuals out of families. And the ones who never got the call were still under condemnation. They were still not worthy of going to Texas or the other places.
So not only have you been ripped of your spouse or your children, you're also in the imprisonment, the mental imprisonment of, I don't measure up to go to Zion.
Yes. Yes. The whole mental is usually a mental prison before it ever became like a physical one. And some people never do get to the physical prison. Some people never got that phone call that told them to go to the Yearning for Zion Ranch. So they didn't realize what it was like there, where I definitely went there and experienced a different version of some of the people that were even there, because some people thought it was going to be this holy city and stuff. But when you get there, it's like they have a guard tower, they have a gate around it, and they have people driving around every 15 minutes and, you know, stuff like that. I noticed where some people may have not even really played into that because they're so brainwashed in their mental prison that they didn't realize it had become a physical prison at that point.
So of the 14 kids, how many of the kids in your family were girls?
Oh, so we had 8 girls and 6 boys.
And for your brothers, they were also told whom to marry, and were any of them kicked out of the sect at all?
Yes, I do have, so 6 brothers, and so my oldest brother is on a repentance mission. So that's basically where he's still a part of the church, kind of, but he has to, like, be worthy to associate with his kids and his family and stuff. So he's just, like, off on a mission to earn money and send it back to the church. And he believes that he needs to do that in order to see his family again, which isn't really the case. He could go out and, you know, try the, you know, apostate version, which is go to the courts, get your kids and all of that. But they don't always want to do that with all the indoctrination. So that's my oldest brother. I have, like, 2 younger brothers. So one of them left the church. I can't talk about all their stories, but, like, one of them, the youngest one, was actually the one that left first. And then I have, like, 4 in the middle and Now, three of those have left, and the other two, so the oldest one is on a repentance mission, kind of a version of leaving, but not really all the way gone. And then there's two that are really active. One of them is being like, one of the two is being like really judged and stuff. So anyway, I don't know what his story will be later. But
of your sisters, how many of them were asked to marry or told to marry someone and they were under the age of 18?
Of my sisters, so that's seven, and count, you know, it's eight counting me, but seven the other ones. Under the age of 18, I think my youngest sister was 16, and that was still legal in Utah when it happened. And that only happened because of, so she's younger than me, but that only happened because of Warren Jeffs becoming the leader and him being so, so controlling. Like, he could call the fathers and tell the fathers, your child is ready to get married. And so, like, if you didn't say yes, then you could lose your whole family at that point, and you'd have to go out through the courts and all of that.
They teach you to be distrusting of the court system.
Yes, very distrusting. And some fathers did pass the test. Some fathers did leave at that point. Where some fathers, that's why you hear of 12-year-olds and things happening more in Warren Jeffs' day, because he changed the system. Before that, the fathers had more say.
So walk me through what happens when you are told that you have to marry Warren Jeffs. Because as I understand it, you were the only one of your family that was asked to marry Warren Jeffs.
Well, one of my older sisters is married to Warren Jeffs, but she was married to Ruland first. So she married Warren Jeffs like a few months before me. It wasn't a whole lot of time.
How was the decision made for you to marry Warren Jeffs?
So basically, the indoctrination taught us three routes. When you walk into the room to talk to the leader, he was going to have the ultimate say in every marriage. But there was like three routes. One of them was he would just tell you who you were going to marry. The other one was he would ask you. He kind of put the weight on you to say, who does God want you to marry? And if you lie, then you'll be severely punished. Like, God knows if you're lying or if you're just like honest about you don't know. The third route was like you actually have to leave the meeting and go and hunt out who you think you're supposed to marry and bring it back. He'll tell you if you're yes or right, yes or wrong, yes or no. So I always had dreams when I was growing up, like premonitions that I was in a darkly lit room. I'd wake up like in the middle of the night and just like sweating and just horrified, because it was like I'd walk into the room, I'd sit down, and it was Warren Jeffs who was the prophet. And I, as a child, it was always Ruland who was the prophet. So in my mind, I thought it was the devil in these meetings. And he would always ask me, who do you think you're supposed to marry? And in my mind, I always thought, I'd been teased a lot as a child that I was going to marry Warren Jeffs anyway. And I think it's because of the way he acted. Maybe some of the reasons why, how the way I acted, because I wanted to be an overachiever. I wanted to be good. So I was accused a lot of wanting to marry Warren Jeffs. So it was like a bullying tactic in my family. And it stems from like a traumatic event that happened when I was 8 years old. So I always wanted to be like an overachiever. And I didn't dare not be, because I had bullies in my family that I thought would turn me in and most likely would have. So they couldn't find like a really significant thing to hold against me. So they'd use my righteousness against me. Mm. That makes sense?
Yep.
So anyway, so I didn't want to step out of line. And usually in those situations, then the leader is also like indoctrinating, singling you out. And it's obvious to some of the people because he does it in public sometimes. And so like, I'm sure he was acting more obvious to some of my family members than even to me, because they had really picked up on it. So I got bullied about it, marrying him my whole life. I had these dreams where I'd just wake up and he'd say, who do you think you're supposed to marry? And I would wake up out of a deep sweat. And I always felt deep down, what am I going to do? Because if it is true, I don't want to lie. You know, if it is true that I'm supposed to go into his family and I lie and he knows he's been grooming me, then what am I going to do? So anyway, when it all came down to it, when I turned 18 years old, so actually when I was 14, one of my friends left the church and she was in an interview and she was one of my school friends. And she talked about how she's afraid she's going to marry Warren Jeffs. And as a child, like growing up, my bullies would they read the article about her and they're like, she was never going to marry him. She shouldn't have even been worried. She should come back. And so it made me have like this idea in my head that I needed to prove myself. And then when I turned 18 years old, I walked into a darkly lit room. My father was with me. My mother didn't get invited to the wedding. And it was Warren Jeffs as the prophet, because he became the prophet like in September, and then the wedding was in January. So it was just right. Like it was just identical to my dream. So I was like going through a flashback, except for every time I'd wake up before I made an answer, like he would say, who are you supposed to marry? And I would wake up. So he said that, who do you think God wants you to marry? And I knew the, I had gone over it in my mind. I'm like, what am I going to say? Because I don't want to lie to him. If I lie, then he's going to punish me. And he's going to know if I'm lying or not, because he's the one that's grooming me. Mm. So in my mind, I said, I turned away, I looked away, and I said, I wondered if I was supposed to go into the family with my sister, who had already gone into his family. So he confirmed it. He had the ultimate say in anything I said. And he said, you're right. You have a strong testimony of God. And then he just went into the ceremony. He didn't actually ask me if I wanted to go into his family. That never came up. It was like, who do you think God told you to? Okay, now let's just go forward. I'm like, well, I don't know if I want to, you know, but like I could say yes or no at the ceremony. But at that point, right. I knew there was a punishment. Yeah. I knew the punishment was real. It wasn't like something I, you know, so I didn't say no, I just said yes. And yeah, that's how that went.
So what is it like? I think a lot of people wondered what it's like, the actual ceremony, having to marry him. Are there certain vows that you're forced to do? Do you have to hold hands? Are there other people that are participating in the ceremony?
Oh, according to the FLDS doctrine, they do have a written out version of what the ceremony looks like. It's in their books. They basically read it word for word. And it has like three witnesses in there. So he did call in two of his brothers because my mother wasn't invited. And one of his brothers did the ceremony, like stood up there in front of us. And we did hold hands. He did talk about like, we agree in the name, in the presence of God and the angels, and all that stuff. At that point, I didn't really listen to the ceremony much. I remember he was mouthing the words because he knew him so well. And I was like, I can't do that. I don't have a clue what they're, you know, I know I've read it before, but I don't have it memorized. But he had done all the ceremonies of everybody else, so he had it memorized. We did have to hold our hands a certain way, and he just told me how to hold it. And yeah. And then he said, he did kiss me at the last, after we both said, yeah, I think we said, I do. I think we said, yeah, I do. And then, we did kiss at the last, and then he sent everybody out of the room, even my father. Anyway, so the vows are in the books. I don't have it memorized even to this day. As far as like, yeah, keeping my vows and all of that, like I have learned, like I only want to if they're like good, you know. Like one thing I really focus on in law and stuff is like at the, you know, there's polygamists, and in Utah, they have it as an infraction to be a polygamist. Like it's basically a parking ticket if you're a polygamist. So that's right now in the laws. I always think about that because like a lot of times that's focused on, polygamy is like really focused on in Utah and other places sometimes, but like mostly in Utah. And so like when they bring it up, I'm like, how can it be so black and white? Like you're an adult or you were a child, because he had intent, like Warren Jeffs at the time of my wedding had intent to make me an accomplice to harder, worse crimes than polygamy. But I didn't know that at the time of my wedding. I didn't realize how dark he was and how far he was going to go. So I don't think we should focus on the wedding as much. You see what I'm saying? As far as in law, I think we need to focus on the farther crimes, the farther, deeper things. So in my mind, I want to focus on coercion, because I think coercion can be broken up for one thing. It's not so black and white. It's not, you know, you're an adult or a child. It's more about like coercion for a felony should stay a felony, where coercion for a misdemeanor maybe could be a misdemeanor. And this way we could get to like topics like maybe if he had an arranged marriage and somebody gets raped in there, he doesn't know they're not going to get raped. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that's my goal. One of my goals is to go into law more deeper topics and use my story, because like I recently had like a court case that I was able to talk about publicly where I testified against Warren in a, like I had it filed for 7 years before I was able to testify in him in federal court. And I just happened last September. So anyway, that's a big deal to me to be able to finally talk about it in a court setting.
Whether you need to buy or sell, or you're just obsessed with looking at homes for sale, Redfin's got you covered. Redfin updates their listings every 2 minutes so you can see new homes first. And they give you personalized recommendations based on the homes that you like, so you can find the home that's just right for you, whether that's a cabin, a craftsman, or a castle. With the top-rated Redfin app, you can favorite homes, share listings with others, and schedule tours, and even on the same day, with a local Redfin agent who can help guide you through the whole home buying process. And if you're looking to sell, Redfin agents have the experience to get you the best price possible for your home. That's because they sell twice as many homes as other agents. With a listing fee as low as 1%, Redfin's fees are half of what others often charge, which means you'll have more money to put towards what matters most to you, like your next home. In fact, last year, Redfin saved home sellers $127 million. No matter where you are in your real estate journey, Redfin can help. Download the Redfin app to get started today.
If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
You've also said that you felt like he didn't like you because you were older, and that he is a pedophile, but you were still unable to escape his abuse. How were you able to escape? Because you were 18, you had been indoctrinated into this church from the time you were born. Somehow something inside of you allowed you to have the physical and emotional strength to escape. What was it? What were the sequence of events that happened for you to be so brave to be able to do that?
So for me, I believe it stemmed from my childhood. My grandparents on my father's side were kicked out of the church when I was like 13. They're more like critical thinkers. And I believe that was kind of indoctrinated in me from my parents, like my father's side. He was definitely a critical thinker. He didn't always express it, but you could see it in his eyes and in his actions and stuff. Or my mother was the one that was all about loyalty and really strong in the faith. So I did have somebody on my side either way it went, but I do feel like for me, it didn't actually hit me as hard until I did get abused. But I did start seeing red flags, even on the wedding night. Like, he was angry at me after he sent the people out of the room, and I hesitated to do what he said. He said, "Come sit on my lap," and I just like hesitated because it's like my first wedding in his 65th. So, you know, there's going to be some hesitation on my part, but he was angry about it. I could see the anger flare up in his eyes. And anyway, ultimately he ended up calling my father back in the room and giving him a list of instructions, telling him I couldn't go back to school because he was running from the law. So I saw red flags on that night, but I didn't actually just put a lot of stock into them at first. Also, I did make some convictions the next morning within myself, which I couldn't tell anybody because everybody around me wanted his interpretations. I did have a lot of sequence of events, and I usually only talk about like some of them. I don't hit like every one of them. There's so many of them. But the next morning he had a secret meeting. So the first meeting I went to was the one on Netflix documentary where it talks about like how he had this meeting where he walked down the aisles and he gave out corrections to all the men in the audience. I was in that audience, but he requested I sit in that audience. And so I was furious because to me, that was like a message of no hope the day after I married him. And then after that meeting, he told my father to bring me to a secret meeting. And in the secret meeting, he talked about how his children were being taken away. Well, the day that he took his children away from his children that were younger than 8 years old, away from the property that he lived in before he became the leader. That story was really intense. He talked about how God revealed that not one of the mothers, the biological mothers that gave birth, were worthy to go with their children at that time that he took them away. That meant like 30 mothers, you know, at least, you know, like 20, 30, you know, any, even one mother that happens to is too many. But like, I was like, God gave him those kids. Why would there be 20 of them that, you know, can't have their kids, you know?
Yeah.
So in my mind, I was like, I'm a wife that doesn't have any kids. And he was taking wives that didn't have any kids to watch the kids. I'm one of those because I just barely got married. So maybe I should go check on those kids. So I made a commitment within myself to go to Texas like the day after my marriage to check on the kids. Even if they aren't my kids, I felt like I had an obligation, you know, to, if I know about something, I should go check. So I did go to Texas. And what I personally believe and witnessed was that the children had less hope than in adoption, because in adoption, the children have hope of stability. They, you know, there's a chance every single day of bonding, where in this setting, whenever they would attach to their caretaker, he would rotate the caretakers. He had the right to just rotate them. So like in a pedophile setting, that would be a perfect situation for him, because he could just like rotate everybody and nobody would ever find out his secrets because the children will never trust anyone to tell anyone. But in like reality, that's horrible. Horrible situation for the kids. What are they going to be like when they grow up and don't trust anyone?
So he set up a system where adults would tattle on each other and the children would keep the secrets for him.
Yeah. He set it so up to where it was like, it was a, you know, and then in my story, as it progresses, I did go into the secret meetings. I did not a lot. I went into the introduction and then I escaped out of that setting. You'll see that in the documentary, like the details of that and stuff. But when I went into when I escaped from Texas for the first time, I had already witnessed what the kids were going through. I felt like I didn't want kids with Warren Jeffs and I had to protect myself. In my situation, I didn't have the option to just slowly work my way out. Like a mother that had kids already, when they did go to Texas, eventually, when God finally revealed that some of the biological mothers could go to Texas, some of those mothers would do anything for the littler kids on the property. That makes sense?
Yes, absolutely.
They would have done anything for their littler kids. So at that point, they had a reason to not become a target. Where in my situation, I didn't have that reason. And I did become a target. I fought against the system, but he had so much say. I did successfully fight against the system. I didn't boldly walk out and say, you know, I'm mad. This is wrong. You know, I didn't do that, because I did see him tell some mothers, you have to stay. You know, he wouldn't give them outlets if they were too bold. I played it like, you know, I need more time. I just don't understand what's going on, you know, and he bought into my story. And anyway, I successfully went to what they called houses in hiding, which are places where if you went to Texas and you weren't like perfect, basically, then you could go to these houses in hiding, which were a middle ground house. So they had the crick where all these people are that are waiting to be called.
Mm-hmm.
It's like their whole pyramid setup. So they're waiting to be called. They go to Texas when they are called, and then they start to struggle. They don't send him back to the creek. They send him to these houses in hiding. And I think it was to keep his secret secret. He didn't want people associating with each other once they'd been called. So we went to these houses in hiding, and I stayed there for 2 years, and then he got caught by the law. The abuse didn't heighten to like such an extreme until after he was caught by the law. And I feel like it was because he knew he had lost his opportunity to bring me in, to make me more of an accomplice. He was really angry at me. He needed somebody to blame internally. He couldn't just have somebody on the outside, you know, the outside came in. Like there had to be somebody internally that caused that system break. And to him, I was the perfect person to do that to. Well, the reason, like when I was in hiding for those 2 years in those houses in hiding, I didn't have anything to do. So I read his doctrines every single day. It ended up saving my life because everybody around me wanted his interpretations. By the end of those 2 years, and especially before that, I had given up on the faith I had been born with. I didn't believe he was the prophet. I didn't believe all of that stuff, but I knew the people around me did. So when they started to heighten my abuse and I was researching for ways out after he was caught, then he put around me the most, like people who were the most loyal, the people who would abuse me, because they would do anything for Warren Jeffs. And I had to fight with his doctrine to get out because he had the ultimate say in everybody's like revelations and everything from the true God. I still believe in God because I saw too many things to, I just don't believe in the God of my childhood. But I saw too many miracles. My life was turned around so many times. But a lot of it had to do with, he had the say to say if our impressions were from God or the devil. So I would never say, I think this. God told me this. I wouldn't say that to anybody. What I would say is, Warren Jeff said this on this day, on this training, and this tape. And they would have to give me opportunities because Warren Jeffs could never be from the devil. They would research it. They'd find out that it was something he actually talks about. And they'd have to give me opportunities because he could never be from the devil. So because I had read so much and had so much indoctrination, I fought like every single hour for 3 years for my life. And so I didn't escape actually. When Warren Jeffs went to prison and all of that, that was happening during the time frame when I was researching my routes out. So that's why the court case I was talking about is like 7 years long, because I didn't escape for like 4 years, at least 4 or 5 years after he was put in prison for life.
So eventually the most amazing thing is that you applied and were granted Warren Jeff's 28,000 square foot home in Colorado City, Arizona, where you once lived as a wife. Partnering with the Phoenix Dream Center, that home has now been remodeled and restored to serve as a place of hope and refuge for other women and children leaving the FLDS. This is incredible. Right. I mean, the work that you're doing is so important. You're there on the ground. There's so many of us that are fascinated by the story and also of those that have had the strength to leave and to reclaim their lives and get their power back. What can you tell us about those that are trying currently to leave the FLDS and of those that have left and what we can do to be of service to them and help them?
Okay, so I love interacting with the people that leave and also the ripple effects. So like sometimes for years, it takes a while for people to clear up their credit or to even get a birth certificate sometimes because some of these children are not born with birth certificates. So our facility that you're talking about, like the Short Creek Dream Center, has like it's case-based. As long as people are keeping the peace in the house and they have their own goals set and they're working toward their own goals, they can stay. So sometimes it could be up to years. And because of like the need, the demand, we prioritize people from this community. So basically, if they come in without a social security number, we hunt for people that were at the birth. It does take time. And most facilities won't even consider that. So our facility is set up for the people from this area for sure. And yes, I do work on the ground. I see a lot of cases. Like our house, like it's 28,000 square feet. I saw a lot to even get it where it is. They had to have their licensing in place. It took them 3 years. So now it's been open for about 2 years where they can fill the whole house to capacity. And it has been full most of the time. So there are times when somebody will leave and we put somebody else new in there. But most of the time we do keep it pretty booked. And there's a lot of ripple effects from people that have, like their father was raised in the creek. And then they were born and they were taught, like, you know, they don't have like the red flags sometimes for domestic violence and stuff in there. Knowledge base, so they end up in domestic violence and stuff like that. So there's ripple effects from a lot of things that we also try to prioritize as something that happened in this area. We do take people from other areas in the world too, but most of the time our priority people do fill up the house pretty much. So and we also, like, not only from this area, but like polygamy groups in general, we do focus on helping people leave if that's what they want. That's our goal. We do have, like, I don't know if this is answering your question, but like, it is like, I love seeing, I have a lot of experience now, but I don't have as much experience as the Phoenix Dream Center and the people that are running the Short Creek Dream Center now. Those people have like 30 years of experience. And for me, I have like only like 5 that I've been really involved, but 2 that I've been working on site. So for me, I've loved to be involved in like seeing the healing process, and I can recognize different stages of it, things that I went through sometimes. I'm actually a peer support specialist also, which is a license, because I have a license because of, like, to become a peer support specialist, you have to have some history in either drug abuse or mental illness. And I do have like a lot of PTSD, so I was able to get my license. And I served there with that license for 20 hours. And I also work 20 hours as an RA, which is right under the Dream Center umbrella. So both of those have different roles, but they're both really crucial, I feel like.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I love seeing the healing process and being a part of it and helping people as much as I can to keep the peace in the house, but also like encouraging them to stay motivated and setting an example in a lot of ways.
Well, I continue to marvel at just how courageous all of these former members are, knowing what a struggle it would be for them financially and emotionally to leave the only life they've ever known without much resource. And the fact that you have created this and continue to do such great work is a testament to your own strength. And I am just really impressed with what you've done out of this hellacious experience that you unfortunately were part of. And I want you to know that this is really meaningful, hearing your story. And I hope that people listening will also feel just as I do. Tell everybody where they can find you and can learn more about the Dream Center.
Okay, so you can find me at briellecker.com, or my Facebook is Brielle Decker Blanchard, because I'm remarried now 6 years. And you can also look up the shortcreekdreamcenter.org. That is their website, and they have a really wonderful website. So yeah, they have a donate button there. We always need funding to support, like, every, you know, it's a nonprofit, so basically everything is free, and it needs to be that way for people that have no way of earning income and stuff like that. So
thank you so much.
Thank you.
The amazing Kate Casey.
I want to thank my guest, Brielle Decker, and remind you to click subscribe and leave a 5-star review. Join the Facebook group, Reality Life with Kate Casey, to talk about this episode and more. You can find me on social media, on Twitter at Kate Casey, Instagram at Kate Casey CA, and TikTok, it's Kate Casey. You can get my must-watch list every Monday in your email box by going to katecasey.substack.com. Make sure also that you listen to all my previous episodes with Jody Weber, retired FBI agent, about the Idaho murder case, and my previous episode to this about this season of The Bachelor, season 27, with Game of Roses podcast hosts Chad and Lizzie, a must listen. And I look forward to circling back with you on Monday with my 600th episode. But lastly, don't forget that I have bonus episodes by going to my Patreon. patreon.com/KKC, where you can get more true crime, lots of life anecdotes, and more information about behind the scenes of this show and of other series of which I will be covering in the next few weeks. So Patreon, patreon.com/KKC.
Murder on My Mind, a new podcast available exclusively on Wondery Plus, explores the circumstances leading up to the murder of two young men and the mistrials of the man accused of killing them. Up-and-coming rapper YNW Melly gained notoriety in the hip-hop world for his shocking lyrics and criminal exploits. When two of his best friends were gunned down in a drive-by shooting, investigators suspected the young rapper staged the scene. But after not one, but two trials that ended in hung juries and new evidence that may place YNW Melly at the scene of the crime, his trial has been paused indefinitely. With countless twists and turns, Law and Crime covers all angles of the case and begs the question, is this young artist the victim of a witch hunt or a silver-tongued devil who's evil to the core? Listen to Murder on My Mind exclusively and ad-free on Wondery Plus. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.